From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Blog swarm is the term now applied to the phenomenon whereby a critical mass of blogosphere chatter forces a story into the mainstream media. It happened on the Dan Rather story, it happened to Jeff James D. Guckert Gannon, and it is precisely what happened to CNN executive Eason Jordan, who, if eyewitness accounts are accurate, suggested that U.S. forces in Iraq have deliberately targeted journalists. Jordan was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, in front of an audience that included Wall Street Journal editorial board member Brett Stevens, who was first among the mainstream media to write about the remarks. Brett, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Brett, Eason Jordan has since resigned his position at CNN, where he worked for more than 20 years. A tape of his speech at Davos exists, but it hasn't been made public. You were there that day. What did he say?
Basically, Jordan came out with a remark in which he seemed to suggest that U.S. forces have not only killed but actually targeted journalists operating in Iraq. And then he sort of let that statement hang. And Barney Frank, the congressman from Massachusetts who was on the panel, jumped in and asked him two questions. First, was it really the case that American soldiers were targeting journalists? And secondly, had CNN done a story about it? Mr. Jordan replied that CNN had not done a story on that specifically, and no, he didn't want to say that it was government policy to target journalists. Instead, he offered a series of other anecdotes, none of which seemed to involve the actual killing of journalists. Now, my impression sitting in the audience is that Mr. Jordan made a comment, and the moment he was challenged on it, was trying very hard to walk it back.
When speculation grew over the following week, the Wall Street Journal seemed willing to cede the story to the bloggers. I mean, you were there, you took notes, but you waited nearly 2 weeks before publishing your account in the Daily Newspaper.
January 30th, Iraq held an election. February 3rd, I think, the president delivered a State of the Union address. There were other large stories out there in the world, and it wasn't, in our view, the biggest story of the day. By the time I then wrote an op-ed for the Journal under my own name on February 10th, it had taken on a kind of life of its own. And so once the blogosphere, in a sense, along with a few other newspapers, had sort of insisted on this issue, it seemed that it was appropriate, as I had been there from the beginning, to offer a comment about it.
There have been a number of analogies employed to describe this phenomenon of the blogosphere grabbing onto a story. One is white blood cells rushing to the site of an infection. And then there's always, of course, the French Revolution, where the mob simply started killing and burning willy-nilly. What are we witnessing here? Are we witnessing the French Revolution? Are we witnessing lupus? What is it?
First of all, I don't have a metaphor of my own, and I would be very reluctant to employ any of those metaphors, particularly the last one. Look, the blog world has, in fact, served, I think, a very useful and important civic function in driving attention to issues that other normal news outlets aren't covering for some reason. Now, in the case of Eason Jordan, I'm not sure that the blog world maintained the right sense of proportion, and this is why. Here, Mr. Jordan made a remark, and it seems that pretty quickly he realized it was a stupid remark. Now, I wonder how many of us haven't in our lives made some kind of comment and said to ourselves, gee, I shouldn't have said that, and tried to unsay it. This was a story kind of driven on the right to get a news executive who was seen as a liberal news executive pushing a liberal agenda. Well, guess what? There's also a left-wing blogosphere, and one day they're going to go after a right-wing news executive. I'm worried about where that leads, especially when organizations like CNN seem to have allowed themselves to sort of be stampeded.
All right. Well, Brett, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Brett Stevens is on the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal. Roni Abovitz also attended the World Economic Forum, invited as a technological pioneer. He works for a Florida biomedical company. But when he arrived in Switzerland, he was asked to write his impressions as a first-time attendee in the forum's weblog. In his first-ever blog entry, Abovitz described his shock at Eason Jordan's charge against the U.S. military. If true, he wrote, quote, it would make Abu Ghraib look like a walk in the park. 11 days later, Jordan had resigned, and Abovitz was credited with igniting the storm that ended his long career at CNN. Roni Abovitz joins us from Florida. Welcome to On the Media.
How are you doing, sir? Thank you.
At what point did you realize that what you'd written as part of the World Economic Forum weblog had taken on a life of its own?
It really struck me when I returned from Europe from the meeting. And when I landed, there was just a whole slew of messages from my office, from our corporate counsel, and CNN and Jordan had been calling. The guys in my company were just totally freaked out. I was actually pretty freaked out, too, that CNN and these people had been calling my office.
You've said that Jordan's inability to defend himself, quote, chummed the waters for the bloggers. Was there anything else that surprised you about how this story developed?
I think the absolute lightning speed and exponential growth of bloggers getting involved was just amazing. But I was really struck by CNN on a few levels. The way their people were trying to do spin with the bloggers, that really, I think, incited many bloggers. And then the fact that there was a videotape, and then, you know, everybody knew that Jordan could basically call up the forum and say, release the tape, and the tape not being released, that was also strange because, you know, here's a news organization. Why wouldn't they want a tape released? And I think that just threw like gasoline on the fire of the bloggers that, you know, there was a cover-up, something was being hidden. It was really handled not in the right way.
You used the metaphor chum to the waters. You sure can't blame a shark for eating. And this was surely a feeding frenzy.
In the blog world, I think there was a group of people, I hope I'm seen as one of those, who was trying to have this open and free democratized debate, which is kind of the idealistic view of what was going on. With others, it was more like blood was in the air and it was like, let's go in for the kill. You could feel that.
Based on your experience, do you believe that democracy and justice is being served? Do you think that there is some sort of tyranny of the mob, or do you fall somewhere in between?
What happens when you wire all of humanity together and give them a lot of empowerment? Is it democracy or is it a giant mob? This should not limit free speech. I think you just have to understand that your speech will be everywhere. It's kind of a new world where as you talk, especially when you talk publicly, with things like blogging, it will get everywhere, and you should feel comfortable about your words.
Roni, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Roni Abovitz is the chief technological officer for Zcat Incorporated and a blogger at fixtheworld.blogs.com.
So it seems that without corroboration, Mr. Jordan made damning insinuations about the U.S. military, and without precisely knowing what he said, right-leaning bloggers made damning insinuations about Mr. Jordan. The Committee to Protect Journalists tracks documented cases of aggression against reporters in conflict zones. Maybe it knows something. Joel Campagna is CPJ's program coordinator for the Middle East. Joel, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
So we do know that the Qatar-based Arab language network Al Jazeera has issued public accusations that they were targeted by U.S. forces in Iraq. Remind us why Al Jazeera has taken this view.
On April 8, 2003, which was one of the last days of combat operations in the war, a U.S. warplane struck an electricity generator outside of Al Jazeera's Baghdad bureau, killing reporter Tariq Ayoub, who had been on the roof at the time. The incident took place in an area of very heavy fighting that day, and Al Jazeera at the same time points out that before the war, they had provided the Pentagon with the coordinates of their bureau. Up till this point, the U.S. military has not conducted an investigation into the incident, so many questions remain unanswered.
Now, if I remember, this isn't the first time that Al Jazeera was hit.
That's true. Just 2 years prior to the incident in Baghdad, Al Jazeera's bureau in Kabul, Afghanistan, had been similarly struck by U.S. missiles. And all we know at this point as far as the Afghanistan incident was a statement from the Department of Defense saying that a known al-Qaeda facility had been hit and that the Pentagon was unaware that the office had been used by Al Jazeera.
Now, one of the most widely publicized incidents involving the U.S. military was the 2003 bombing of the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad, during which two foreign correspondents were killed. Many, many reporters, as a matter of fact, from many news organizations were housed in that hotel.
Well, in the case of the Palestine Hotel, as you mentioned, we concluded through a thorough investigation that it wasn't a deliberate attack, but it could have been avoided because commanders were aware that the Palestine Hotel had been used as a base by the foreign media, which were covering events in Baghdad. Yet, for some reason, that information was not passed on to troops on the ground.
But Central Command did, in fact, launch an investigation of the Palestine Hotel incident, and it called the shelling fully in accordance with the rules of engagement. This is a phrase that pops up in other investigations. What does it mean?
To date, what the rules of engagement are remains unclear. The Pentagon keeps those classified. And in the case of the Palestine Hotel, the troops on the ground believed that they were firing at Iraqi military who were directing artillery at U.S. troops.
There was another more recent attack involving an Al Arabiya reporter, Mazen Tumezi. Could you give us a brief sketch of what happened there?
He had been covering with a number of other journalists a disabled U.S. Bradley fighting vehicle, which a few hours earlier had been attacked by insurgents. And he was killed when a U.S. helicopter opened fire on the disabled Bradley in an apparent attempt to destroy the vehicle and prevent it from falling into the hands of insurgents. This is a case which has raised concerns for a number of journalists about whether U.S. troops are using indiscriminate force or failing to take into account the presence of civilians when making targeting decisions.
Joel, based on your research, does it appear that U.S. forces have ever deliberately targeted journalists in Iraq?
There is no evidence to conclude that the U.S. military has deliberately targeted the press in Iraq. If we look back at the overall threats to journalists in Iraq, there are many. And actually, insurgent actions account for over 60% of journalist deaths since March of 2003. The second leading cause of death has been the U.S. military. At least 9 journalists and 2 other media support workers have been killed by U.S. forces fire. And when journalists are killed, we've seen the military seems at times indifferent or unwilling to launch complete transparent investigations or to take forceful steps to help mitigate risk so that in the future journalists are not killed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel Campagna is the Committee to Protect Journalists Program Coordinator for the Middle East.
Coming up, Ceylon celebrates its 10th birthday. That's 83 in web years. And a new study shows that journalists have ethics after all.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Long before the army of online citizen journalists known as bloggers became the talk of media circles, there were online magazines. Namely, there was Ceylon.com. 10 years ago, when David Talbot started Ceylon, it was a brand new animal, a publication that had good writing and good thinking, but existed only on the internet, no paper version at all. It seemed revolutionary, not to mention a little implausible. But that was 10 years ago. Today, it's not only still going, but we hardly even consider it a fringe source. It is legit. Maybe that's why it was time for David Talbot to move on. He's stepping down from his major Ceylon responsibilities, and he joins me now from San Francisco. David, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob.
Take me back 10 years to you trying this quixotic startup. What was the pitch, and how was it received?
Well, it was hard. A lot of people hadn't even heard of the web at that point. So when I was out raising money, I had to explain not only this was a new magazine, and we were going to be based in San Francisco, not New York, where all publishing is based, but it was going to be on something called the internet, which was definitely a tough sell to most people.
You wrote that part of the reason you can now leave Ceylon is that the magazine's survival is no longer in doubt. Let's talk about the business side. How profitable is the magazine, and how has the model changed over the years?
Well, Salon has had many, many near-death experiences, and I'm just as stunned as most people to be at this point where Salon has turned its first profit last quarter. We made $400,000, a delightful figure. We've been written off so many times now that I feel like I've come back from the dead. The key thing, I think, for Salon was when we were able to start charging subscriptions about 3 years ago. And when we did that, we showed that, lo and behold, internet publishing could be just like traditional publishing and get revenue not only from advertisers, but from our readers.
Let's talk about some of your near-death experiences. They're always fascinating. Was there one that was particularly terrifying or maybe particularly heroic? I mean, do you have a PT-109?
One of Salon's, I think, scariest near-death experiences came about halfway into our existence when a person who the investors had put on our board to kind of babysit us, he took me and my business partner, Michael O'Donnell, out for breakfast at a very lovely hotel here in downtown San Francisco, surrounded by tourists enjoying their breakfast with their children. And this fellow cut right to the chase and said, "I'm going to shut you down." I jumped to my feet and said, "No, we're going to shut you down," and proceeded to tell him exactly what I thought about him. And lo and behold, it seemed to work because he backed off. And shortly thereafter, he helped us, actually. So that was an important turning point. Another, I think, rocky moment for Salon occurred during the Clinton impeachment wars, which is when I think Salon really came of age journalistically. While the rest of the media bandwagon was out for Clinton's scalp, we were more interested in reporting on Ken Starr, what was motivating the strange inquisition and so on. And this antagonized a lot of critics of President Clinton. We were inundated with hate mail, hate email, death threats. Our building had to be emptied one day because of a bomb threat. Again, we came of age through the fires of these various crucibles and fought on.
There is another online magazine called Slate.com. But only one. Now, Macy's builds next to Gimbel's, but it's been 10 years. Where are Bloomingdale's? Where's Nordstrom? Where are the rest of the magazines that you would have thought would have sprung up along the path that you've blazed?
Yes. Well, that's one of the startling and puzzling questions I still have. When we launched Salon, we thought it was going to be one flower in an abundant garden. And that was the case for the first few years, of course. But unfortunately, most websites weren't able to develop a business model and quickly disappeared, despite the high quality of many of them. Slate, one of our competitors, had the advantage of being backed by a little company called Microsoft, so they were able to battle on. We're now entering the era of the blog instead, but as great as many of these blogs are, they're not professional newsrooms, and there's only so much that a lone blog voice can do in the pursuit of truth and justice in American media. And I think it's hard to replace the kind of critical mass and collective energy that a newsroom has, where journalists, reporters, editors bouncing ideas off of each other, working the phones, burning shoe leather to track down stories. To me, that's journalism at its best.
And as revolutionary as your magazine must have seemed a decade ago, really the only thing new media about it is the way it's distributed over the internet. Is there a chance that because of the growth of the blogosphere that Salon and Slate themselves will be rendered obsolete by the geometric growth of the blogosphere?
No, I don't see blogs replacing publications like Salon any more than Salon replaced the newspaper industry or the magazine industry. You know, we need new ways for new talent to bubble up. So I welcome the blogs. I welcome their energy. And I think Salon will thrive because of this new energy that's being brought into journalism. But the main thing is, I think it's important for Salon to stay independent. It's one of the few national publications at this point in conglomerate media America that stands on its own feet. The only people we had to answer to here at Salon over the last 10 years was ourselves and our readers. And there are not many journalists that can say that.
Well, David, best of luck to Salon and to you.
Thanks so much, Bob.
David Talbot is moving on after starting Salon.com 10 years ago. He's setting out to write a book about the Kennedys called Brothers.
Despite some very public media malfeasance and mea culpas lately, it turns out that we in the press employ an ethical standard that is significantly higher than in most other professions. Really? No, really. That's according to a study co-authored by Renita Coleman, a professor of communications at Louisiana State University. Her findings refute the conventional wisdom that ranks reporters just above car salesmen. Renita Coleman is herself a former journalist turned academic. Renita, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Renita, either journalists really are ethical or maybe we just test well. So let's talk about the test. The one that you used was developed around 30 years ago and is composed of a number of hypothetical situations, right? And then there are questions about those situations. So sketch out one of those scenarios.
Yes, that's correct. There's six ethical situations that people are asked to solve. Everything from should a man steal a drug for his wife who will die without it and the pharmacist, cold-hearted as he is, won't give it to him, to you've been living next door to a model citizen for 10 years and then you find out that he's a escaped prisoner, should you turn him in? There's six of those. They're true dilemmas in the sense that there's no one right answer.
So how do you score the test?
Well, we really are not as concerned with what you decide to do in the situation, as in what kinds of things play an importance in your decision making. So if you say that you're interested in what this means for society, but you want to balance individuals' rights, then that's a high quality ethical reason. If you say, well, I'm going to do this because it will help my career, then that is not as high a quality ethical reason.
Before, when I suggested that maybe we journalists test well, I was only partly kidding. Can it be that journalists are well-trained to sound ethical?
No. Well, the psychologists who developed this test did a very good job. They have built in some checks and balances to make sure that you can't, in their terms, fake high. There's some statements in there that are written to sound important and to sound highly ethical.
Give me an example.
Whether the essence of living is more encompassing than the dignity of dying, I believe, is one of them. There's one that's a euthanasia problem.
Mm-hmm.
And people will say, oh, that played a tremendous amount of importance in their ethical reasoning. And it's usually chosen by people who don't really understand that sentence, but they think, oh, this must be one of the good ones. So if you check too many of those, we purge you from the data.
I'm encouraged that journalists perform so well, but now I want to know who fared better and who fared worse.
Physicians, seminarians, they fared better. Philosophers fared better than journalists. Nurses, dentists, adults in general, graduate students did not do as well. Age and education are the two primary factors that are involved in higher quality ethical reasoning. So people who scored highly had PhDs or medical degrees. Most of our journalists have bachelor's degrees, so it was really an impressive finding.
In fact, they scored higher than their education level might have suggested?
That's correct.
You didn't break this down according to religion?
Religion correlates with high ethical reasoning up to a point, and then as people begin to be more religious, their ethical reasoning gets lower. So it's a curvilinear relationship. So one of the findings is that relying too much on religious doctrine and rules can actually inhibit good quality ethical reasoning sometimes.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And we're not the only ones who found that. There's been many studies that have been done that have come to the same conclusion.
Did you learn anything about what it means to think like a journalist?
Well, I think we did. We asked journalists if they'd done any investigative reporting, and we found that that was correlated with higher quality ethical reasoning. The whole point is to investigate and expose wrongdoing. So immediately you're making a moral judgment. It's not objective reporting the way beat reporting is. So we hypothesize that journalists who have some experience with investigative reporting work have thought about moral questions and ethical questions in greater depth, and that has somehow taken them to a higher place.
Well, Renita, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Renita Coleman is an assistant professor of communications at Louisiana State University. So it turns out journalists are better than average at untying ethical knots. But some of those knots require extra help. So a few years ago, the Chicago Headline Club and the Center for Ethics and Social Justice at Loyola University Chicago launched a service called the Ethics Advice Line. Reporters could dial 866-DILEMMA for ethical help in a hurry. But what journalist is going to outsource a decision that could break a career? In fact, how would they even know that they could? So, for the advancement of ethics in journalism, we offered this promo for OTM's Ethics Hotline.
I was confused. I needed direction.
The Ethics Hotline.
I didn't know who to source, I didn't know when to footnote, and I didn't know where to turn.
The Ethics Hotline.
Then I called the Ethics Hotline.
Don't trust those other so-called ethicists. The Ethics Hotline has ethics experts standing by 24 hours a day to help you with all your ethical needs.
Hello, Ethics Hotline. I've been a very naughty journalist. I have the urge to blow this story all out of proportion.
Sorry, we're not that kind of hotline.
Hello, Ethics Hotline. I picked up a murder plot on my baby monitor. Can I report it?
Ethics Hotline can help.
I have evidence that exonerates Puffy Combs, but I hate his music. What should I do?
Ethics Hotline can help.
Hello, Ethics Hotline. I plagiarized the Bible. Am I going to hell?
Yes.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Damn you, Hotline. I'm taking you down with me.
Ethics Hotline, $5 a first minute, 99 cents each additional minute.
That's a hoot.
Dr. Ozar, would you say it's unethical to make fun of a service without actually talking to the people who launched it?
It depends on your purpose.
So if we were unfair then, we're going to rectify it now. David Ozar is an ethicist and professor of philosophy at Loyola Chicago University and co-founder of the Ethics Advice Line for Journalists. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, even though that study I referred to found that journalists were highly ethical, a 2004 Gallup survey showed that only about 20% of Americans said they thought that journalists had high or very high ethical standards.
Well, when I came to this, I expected journalists in general to be less ethically sensitive and less skilled at doing the ethical thinking. But I think I'd say my committee's universal impression of the people we deal with is that they're very conscientious. They care a lot, and the reason they're calling is that they either are really puzzled and want a little coaching about how to think through a hard issue, or they're pretty sure of the answer, but they want to get some confirmation, or they're pretty sure of the answer, and they've got somebody above them in the system who is, shall we say, less sure, and they want a little advice about what to do about that. But most of the people are calling out of their sense of professionalism.
What news organizations are these callers calling from?
Well, most of them are from print media. I would guess that more than a third of the calls are coming from mid-sized journalist organizations, mid-sized cities. About the same amount are coming from small operations, people out, so to speak, in the sticks who don't have somebody at the next desk they can even talk to. And the remainder, maybe 20%, from freelancers. We have had very, very few calls from people from the big organs, and I suspect that's because many of the big organizations have their own ethics advice system internally. At least I hope so.
What do people typically ask for help in?
Well, about half of the calls we get are on conflict of interest issues, and about 40% of them are on people weighing, to put it simply, benefits and harms of doing a story or taking some other sort of journalistic action.
Can you give me an example of the benefit versus harm?
Investigative reporter has found out some real dirt on a politician that the investigative reporter thinks is a real sleazebag. This particular politician is about to run for state office against another politician that the reporter thinks is a sleazebag. Let's call them Sleaze A and Sleaze B.
Mm-hmm.
The reporter's got really good dirt on Sleaze A. He could probably undo him, he thinks. But he thinks Sleaze B is even worse than Sleaze A. So if he undoes Sleaze A with this revelation, he's afraid Sleaze B will win the election.
It's a tough one.
Yeah, so exactly. His worry is that if he does the journalistic thing and tells the truth as he's found it, he's going to hurt the public by enhancing the position of a worse sleazebag.
But to not do the story is to deprive the public of information that would be useful.
Exactly.
Even if he doesn't have equivalent information on Sleaze B.
Exactly. And in a sense, this guy has to trust the voters. It's not his job to elect people and unelect people. You know, the benefit that the public knows these things outweighs the potential harm that the public might make a mistake.
Your website says that the service is for, quote, professional journalists who are seeking the correct course of ethical conduct when covering the news. Isn't a right choice versus a wrong choice subjective?
Depends on how you mean the word subjective. If subjective means there is no correct answer that anyone could ever come to, it's just, you know, a flip of your gut thing. Well, I mean, there are people who take that view, but particularly within a profession, it's not a very viable view. I mean, journalists have made a set of commitments to a set of standards that they intend to live by, and they present these to the community as how they intend to live. And the community accords them authority and access, and most importantly, believes them most of the time, in proportion as they live that integrity commitment, and the community believes they're living it.
Do you ever find a situation when somebody wants to do the right thing for the wrong reason?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Here's a story. Fellow calls in and says, I'm a freelancer. I write for a lot of local newspapers, and I've just written a book, and I really want to sell it. And I bought a self-help How to Market Your Wares book, and it says what I should do is write letters to the editor and op-ed pieces to tout my book. And my question to you is, can I do this for the very same newspapers that I freelance in? And I said to him, well, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that you could do this for any paper you wanted. And the bad news is that since you're a journalist and you know what op-ed pieces and letters to the editor are for, you know that they're not for touting products. So he said, so I can't do it at all. I said, well, sounds like it.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Ozar is the director of the Center for Ethics and Social Justice at Loyola University Chicago and co-founder of the Ethics Advice Line for Journalists.
Coming up, our endless fascination with deep throat. Both of them.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It seems like we struck a nerve last week. We had letters on nearly every topic, like this one on our interview with Brooks Jackson of FactCheck.org on the argument over the president's plan for Social Security. Doug Hoffling of Salt Lake City writes, I found it interesting that your guest performed veritable linguistic gymnastics in order to avoid saying that President Bush had intentionally deceived or lied, saying instead that people, quote, might get the wrong idea from the president's words. He then engaged in those same gymnastics in reverse order to say flat out that the MoveOn.org ad about the same subject was just not true, calling it a false ad because of its juxtaposition of words and pictures. Who's fact-checking the fact-checkers?
Several listeners thought Bob was too tough on Jackson Herald editor Mike Buffington, who excoriated Walmart for seeking free PR from community newspapers while never buying any ad space in them. Julian H. Breen of Pennington, New Jersey writes, "The cracks in your ivory tower were showing when you tried to make the story into a morality tale of journalism ethics. If, as you attempted to badger Buffington, there should be absolutely no relationship whatsoever between paid advertising and news coverage, then the automotive and real estate industries would see many fewer stories than they do now amid reams of paid advertising, even in such bastions of journalistic integrity as the august New York Times."
And we got a strong response to the interview with Alan Pezzato of Alabama Public Television, one of many PBS affiliates who chose not to run an episode of a kids' show called Postcards from Buster because it showed lesbian parents. Gary Washburn saw the episode aired by WGBH Boston, and he found it, quote, about as offensive as a church picnic. But then he's writing from Jamaica, Vermont. What really bothered him, he writes, is that viewers were not informed of the decision of many stations not to air it. He writes, quote, this amounts to a sort of stealth censorship, which, added to the more crypto censorship we receive from commercial counterparts to PBS, presents an edifice of deception and manipulation in which it's impossible to trust anything we see or hear. Without the censor's stamp or blacked out pages or bleeped out four-letter words, the work of the censor is unaccountable to the actual consumers, however much attention it might receive in alternative media.
Many listeners wrote in to cheer Bob's treatment of the Jeff Gannon story, the man with the false name who threw softball questions during presidential press conferences. David Christian of Iowa City wrote, "Oh, snap! That's what I yelled to myself in my empty house after hearing Mr. Garfield's thoughts on Mr. Gannon and his non-role as a journalist. Thank you."
But Danielle Mazur of New York City said we skipped over some key points. Among them, the fact unearthed by the Daily Coast blog that Gannon had access to the government source who outed CIA official Valerie Plame. "Why, for God's sakes," she writes, "was this guy given access to confidential government documents? Somebody other than the diligent bloggers needs to investigate this. Somebody with access to the hallowed halls of our so-called liberal mainstream media."
Keep those letters coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. On the matter of Valerie Plame, the CIA official named in a column by Bob Novak, the investigation into who leaked her name goes on. It's not known whether Novak has cooperated with investigators. He has not been charged. But there have been serious consequences for two other reporters, Judith Miller of the New York Times and Matthew Cooper of Time magazine. They did not leak Plame's name, but they are alleged to have received that information and have been charged with contempt of court for refusing to reveal their source.
This week, Cooper and Miller lost their appeal and may soon be heading to jail. They say they won't reveal their source because it would discourage other whistleblowers if they did. In this case, the leaker was up to no good. But frequently, leakers expose government wrongdoing that would otherwise be secret. They are a check on the abuse of power. They can change history.
"The money's the key to whatever this is."
"Says who?"
"Deep Throat."
"Who?"
"Oh, that's Woodward's garage freak, his source in the executive."
"Garage freak? Jesus, what kind of a crazy story is this?"
Who can forget those halcyon days of 30 years ago when a man with a cigarette in a parking garage helped to bring down a president? That man told Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein to follow the money, and it led straight to Richard Nixon. We never found out who that man was, but we're still trying. Recently, former Nixon White House counsel John Dean said his secret source told him Deep Throat was ill, setting off a new round of sleuthing. And last week, a name Deep Throat poll conducted by editor and publisher named ailing Chief Justice William Rehnquist as the likeliest leaker, a conjecture that Dean reportedly laughed off. Other contenders include former FBI Director L. Patrick Gray, Nixon advisor Alexander Haig, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and even former President George Herbert Walker Bush, among many others. But Woodward says he won't tell till Deep Throat's dead.
But maybe we don't have to wait. After all, former Washington Post editor Ben Bradley famously claimed that there were enough clues to figure it out. And back in May of 2003, that's pretty much what a journalism class at the University of Illinois says it did. After crunching the data for 4 years, it determined that Fred Fielding, a lawyer in the Nixon White House, was Deep Throat. In 2003, we spoke to William Gaines, the professor who spearheaded the project. I asked him why he spent 4 years trying to finger Deep Throat.
"I saw a list of the 10 greatest mysteries of the 20th century, and Deep Throat was number 5. Amelia Earhart was number 1. And it struck me at the time that nobody knows what happened to Amelia Earhart, but somebody knows who Deep Throat is, and they're not telling us. So I guess that became a challenge. And also added to that challenge was a statement that Ben Bradley, you know, the editor of Woodward and Bernstein at the time, made recently that somebody could probably take all the information known about Deep Throat and put it in some huge computer, and they'd be able to figure out who Deep Throat was.
So it was a game of mega clue, a process of elimination that finally led you to Fred Fielding in the garage with a leak. Do you think we'll ever know? I mean, this is...
Well, I know.
Do you know? I
know who Deep Throat is. It's Fred Fielding. There's no question about it. Nobody else could be Deep Throat but Fred Fielding. He had access to all the information. He's the only person who fits Woodward and Bernstein's description, and not coincidentally, he has access to all the information that Deep Throat had, some of it almost exclusively. So it just cannot be somebody else.
All right, let's just say that you and your class are right, that Fred Fielding is Deep Throat. I still have to ask you, why? Carl Bernstein, for one, was apoplectic about this exercise. To paraphrase him, shouldn't you be teaching your students about the sanctity of confidential sources instead of trying to unmask them? How say you?
Well, absolutely. I teach my students you never, ever reveal a source. What we have here is a situation where a source has been revealed by Woodward and Bernstein. They've told us that he smokes and he drinks scotch and so forth. They made a movie character out of him. That's not how you treat a source. You keep it absolutely in confidence. So what they've done is made a guessing game out of it. A lot of people who are not Deep Throat have been wrongfully named over the years, and it's caused quite a stir. And I think that our investigation was more or less driven by public opinion, because people don't like questions of that nature. They don't like the idea of a journalist saying, I know something you know and I'm not telling you. They want to know the answer.
Inquiring minds want to know.
That's right, and journalists should respond to that, and that's what we did.
I don't want to be too obnoxious about this, but Inquiring Minds Want to Know is the slogan of the National Enquirer, which does just as you say. It meets the demands of the reading public. Does the fact that the public craves the identity of Deep Throat give you reason enough to provide it?
I think so, because these are serious-minded people who want to set the record straight. They don't want Woodward and Bernstein to be in control at the time that Deep Throat dies and is the only person who can testify as to why he did it and what he did. I have had a lot of very interesting emails because of our website, and people want to praise Fred Fielding.
Fair enough, although if Deep Throat wishes to remain anonymous, I'm not sure that that's to the point. Let me ask you something else. You yourself are a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner for your investigative work. And I imagine in doing the work that you did at the Chicago Tribune in the 70s, I presume that some of your work depended on help from confidential sources. How would you like it if someone went in your wake and tried to dig them up and identify them?
As long as you don't give out any information about your source, how possibly could they do that? You know, in our investigation, the student investigation, we have anonymous sources who provided us with information. A lot of times, persons would talk off the record, and both I and the students kept that confidence. We didn't do as Woodward and Bernstein did, give anybody any kind of a clue as to whether he or she was our particular source with this information. It was like a military exercise, you know, not using real bullets. And I hope that what we have done over the years that I've done this is arm young reporters with knowledge so they can do investigations of their own that might be more important than revealing who Deep Throat is.
All right. William Gaines, thank you very much.
Thank you.
William Gaines is a professor of journalism at the University of Illinois.
The man in the garage spoke on deep background, which meant his identity was top secret. And he helped to expose the immoral actions of the commander-in-chief. Maybe that's why Howard Simons, managing editor of the Washington Post, dubbed him Deep Throat, after the blockbuster porn film that was on everyone's mind. Some say the country changed on June 17, 1972, when burglars were caught breaking into Democratic Party National Committee offices in the Watergate Hotel. But maybe it changed on June 12th, when Deep Throat opened. As surely as Watergate changed the political climate, Deep Throat signaled a shift in the cultural wind. For some, it was refreshing. For others, chilling.
We have smut all over the face of this country now because we are letting those immoral people have their way in our country.
I just saw it, and I liked it. I liked it. I wanted to see a dirty picture, and that's what I saw. But I want the right to see that picture. I don't want somebody telling me that I can't see a dirty picture.
That was the reaction to Deep Throat in 1972, which appears in a new documentary called Inside Deep Throat about the movie. And later this month, after decades of gathering dust in the back rooms of video stores, Deep Throat itself returns to about 20 theaters, presumably for midnight screenings.
Meanwhile, this week the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed an indecency enforcement bill that would boost the FCC's maximum indecency fines from just over $32,000 for broadcast stations and $11,000 for performers up to $500,000 for both. NBC said the vagueness and inconsistency of the FCC's standards indiscriminately threaten a wide variety of programs and raise serious free speech issues. And in other blue news, the Justice Department said Thursday it would appeal a recent court decision that declared federal obscenity laws unconstitutional.
Everything old is new again. Janet Jackson is no Linda Lovelace, but they both gave new fuel to the censors. Hollywood didn't mind, though, in 1972, because independent blockbusters like Deep Throat were stealing box office. In fact, author John Lewis contends that Hollywood has happily muzzled itself for more than half a century to protect its bottom line. His book is called Hollywood vs. Hardcore, and his tale begins 25 years before Deep Throat, with the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Mr. Lewis, why start your story there?
Well, a couple of things are happening in 1947. One is the blacklist. Another is a well-predicted box office decline. Also happening at the same time are the emerging unions, which are becoming very powerful in Hollywood in the early 1940s. What the blacklist allows them to do is to regulate their workforce, to basically blacklist people by simply labeling them as communists.
So HUAC set the scene then for censorship. When does censorship of sexual content enter the picture?
Well, there had been censorship of sexual content since the 1930s with the Production Code Administration. But in the 1950s, the U.S. Supreme Court has a series of decisions that allow for a wider range of material in films and also allow theaters to show a wider range of material without local censors stopping them. The studios start releasing films like Tea and Sympathy, Baby Doll, eventually in the 60s, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which clearly defy the original production code. And it becomes necessary on the part of the studios to develop a new system that would accommodate their own membership. And that new system is the Motion Picture Association of America rating system that we have in effect today, which allowed R-rated films. So there was nudity and there was violence and there was explicit language.
Set the scene for us. During the Nixon administration, what were the big selling films in 1972?
Well, the biggest film in 1972 was Godfather, and it seemed to usher in a kind of new era in American film, what was called the auteur era. And on the other hand, you have a whole group of hardcore films that are doing incredibly well at the box office, films like Deep Throat, which is the most famous of them, Behind the Green Door, and actually the film that did the best at the box office, The Devil and Miss Jones. And what I think surprised the studios was that once the market got open, completely open and unregulated, everybody in America seemed to want to go see these hardcore films.
And the studio responded how?
Well, by panic. That's how they respond to everything. On the one hand, they knew they couldn't make these kinds of films, being the kinds of corporations that they were. But at the same time, they risked losing the audience forever to these hardcore films. And what happened was, of all people, Richard Nixon, who was on the House Committee on Un-American Activities back in the late 40s, basically made it very difficult to show a porn film in a public theater. Because if your community, based on its unique community standards, objected to the material in your film and could deem it obscene, that Supreme Court would basically uphold that decision. And the result was that overnight, films like Deep Throat, Devil and Miss Jones, and Behind the Green Door were isolated in just single theaters in so-called bad neighborhoods of big cities instead of just playing everywhere. And by the end of the 70s, the studios have the entire marketplace to themselves, and they have the rating system, and luckily enough, Richard Nixon to thank for that.
And so that is how the struggle over censorship saved the modern film industry, as you described.
Yeah, I suppose in a nutshell, that's true. There's a famous saying in Hollywood that when they say it's not about the money, it's about the money. And that's what censorship's all about. It's never about morality. It's always about money.
Mr. Lewis, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you.
John Lewis is the author of Hollywood versus Hardcore.
You say that you want more out of sex than just a lot of little tingles.
Yes, I want to hear bells and bombs.
Yes, we just went through that, Miss Lovelace. Let's not do that one again. You know, I think your problem might be physical instead of psychological. Have you ever had a internal examination?
No, I don't think so.
Step into my examination room. I want to take a look at you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, with help from Rob Christensen. We also had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gulowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media, produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the New School in New York City, offering an interdisciplinary graduate program in media studies. Fall application deadline March 15th. Information at nsu.newschool.edu/PRI. Also from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.